Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the most complicated foreign policy challenge President Obama faces, the collapse of Syria and the rise of the self-declared Islamic State that is now poised to destroy the ancient Roman city of Palmyra, that is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Veteran Middle East correspondent Martin Smith joins us. He has covered the Middle East for PBS's Frontline for more than a decade, most recently with the rise of ISIS. And we will discuss his follow-up Frontline report that premieres tonight on PBS stations and online at pbs.org/frontline, Obama at War. Then, as if the region is not complicated enough, we will discuss the explosive addition of civilian nuclear power reactors, with Russia set to build 4 reactors in Turkey this year, having secured agreements to build more in Algeria, Egypt, Iran, and Jordan, joining South Korea with contracts to build 4 plants in the United Arab Emirates. Bennett Ramberg, who served in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the George H.W. Bush administration and is the author of Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy, joins us to discuss his article in Foreign Affairs, Nuclear Power to the People, the Middle East's New Gold Rush, and the competition between Argentina, Canada, China, the Czech Republic, Finland, France, Japan, the UK, Russia, and the US, who are all bidding to enter the Saudi market to build up to 18 nuclear power reactors. Then finally, we will speak with Robert Miller, a marine ecologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara, about the impact that the oil spill on the beaches near where the UCSB campus is situated is having on marine life, birds, and mammals. He joins us to discuss the lasting damage that oil spills inflict on the marine environment after the surface oil is skimmed, often with the use of controversial dispersants. And joining us now is Martin Smith, who is a veteran documentary producer and correspondent, whose most recent PBS Frontline documentary was The Rise of ISIS. He is the writer, producer, and correspondent of Frontline's Obama at War, which premieres tonight on PBS stations and online at pbs.org/frontline. Welcome to Background Briefing, Martin Smith.
Thank you, Ian.
And the New York Times on Tuesday is reporting that ISIS is in the crosshairs, but the U.S. is holding back to protect civilians. Yet another example of a kind of tormented and conflicted war. From the beginning, it's always been clear that the Russians and the Iranians knew what they want, and they're getting what they want. But on the American and the Allied side, if that's not too generous a term, we seem to have known what we don't want, but we don't seem to know what we do want.
Well, I think that the president is educated by our experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he's reluctant to get us involved in another ground war in the Middle East. He's promised the American people when he came to office that he was there to get us out of war. So I think that that's, you know, some people will say the pendulum has swung too far, that it's all well and good to get us out of wars, but if the end result is a regional conflagration and the rise of ISIS across North Africa and all the way into Afghanistan, then you have to ask yourself, well, just what is the way to get it right? And I think that's what the president has struggled with, and I think it's a very difficult set of decisions to intervene, to not intervene, who to arm, who to back. It's been very tough.
Well, apparently the extent of Iran's involvement has grown to the point where my understanding is that there have been a purge of Assad's military ranks at the highest levels, those that are unhappy about Iran's increasing control, in effect, of the military situation. I think it's pretty clear without Iran, Assad would have already folded. What do you think?
Well, I don't know the details on what you're talking about right there. I certainly agree in general that without Iran's backing, Assad would have fallen. As to how much internal meddling there's been, it doesn't surprise me what you lay out there. The truth is that it's very difficult for Americans to get involved in Middle Eastern wars like this when you have so many players running proxy armies meddling in Iraq and Syria. You know, the best thing I think that one could do is to figure out how to get everybody to just stay out and let these civil wars run their course. But, of course, that's not going to happen. You've got Saudis, Qataris, Emiratis, Turks, Kuwaitis. Everybody's got a hand in, including Iran, of course, as you mentioned, trying to you know, back their client, and it makes it a very difficult thing for the United States to decide, well, who are they going to come in? Who are they going to back? Can we trust that the people we back are really going to be winners? And if, indeed, in some kind of grand coalition, Assad was to fall, who's going to replace him? So all these are big questions.
Well, again, though, the Russians and the Iranians at least have been consistent. And on our side, or on the other side, if you will, there's some confusion, isn't there, with so many different militias involved. When you bring all those players in that you just mentioned, Turkey, the Qataris, Saudi, etc., and the U.S. with the backing the so-called Free Syrian Army, the results seem to have ended up with, essentially, you end up backing either the Islamic State or the al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra. Is that pretty much the conclusion that you've come to?
Well, by not backing the Free Syrian Army, and their ranks have dwindled because they've never received vigorous support from the United States or even European nations. And so many of their soldiers have quit and gone off to join extremist groups like Nusra Front, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate, or with ISIS. It is much simpler for the Russians and the Iranians to be backing Assad. They're not dealing with the whole, you know, mess of various rebel groups. There's, by some estimation, 1,000 different rebel groups. Some of them are, you know, a gang that controls a block of territory in Aleppo. So it's an enormously complex landscape. And for the Americans to be nimble enough to play on that battlefield, it's a tall order.
And again, I'm speaking with Martin Smith, who's a veteran documentary producer and correspondent, whose most recent PBS Frontline documentary was The Rise of ISIS. He is the writer, producer, and correspondent of Frontline's Obama at War, which premieres tonight on PBS stations and online at pbs.org/frontline. So I guess in many ways, the fateful turn of events was when Obama made that remark about if the Syrian regime were to use chemical weapons, that would be crossing a red line. I mean, you can go back earlier to statements made by Secretary Clinton suggesting that Assad would fall. Apparently, the Turks also believed that. That didn't happen. But what did you learn about that fateful remark, which, of course, at the end of the day, the president had to back away from?
I think what's interesting here is that this wasn't the president coming into the press room and with a statement about what he would do if chemical weapons were clearly being used by the regime. Instead, it was the last question of a press conference that was dealing with other issues. And the president was improvising, but the president, surprising all his aides, came out with a statement about how there would be enormous consequences if Assad began to use chemical weapons. He called it a red line that would change his calculus. I think what you're seeing there is the president, who very much wants to put a stop to this horror of tens of thousands of people dying in Syria, and he makes a threat. I think, you know, if he had thought about it, he would have certainly realized that he was painting himself into a corner, potentially. That's exactly what happened. But I think it was his conflict over wanting to intervene, but not wanting to intervene, not wanting to drag us into a war, but at the same time get a stop to what was going on.
Well, in the documentary, a member of the Syrian opposition points out that the tragic consequences of the president's remark, and says that this has basically given every tinpot dictator in the world a free pass. If the United States, you know, throws down the gauntlet and then backs away from it, it has catastrophic consequences. Do the administration people you talk to feel that it's had those kind of consequences?
Well, I think everybody was pretty surprised by the comment. And the Syrian opposition goes on to point out that following the president not following through on the threat of using military force against the regime, the extremists were able to go to the Syrian people and say, look, you've been betrayed by the Americans. They're not, they don't have your back. We have your back. Come with us. Stay with us. We will protect you. And to one degree or another, depending on who you talk to, but certainly the ambassador Robert Ford of Syria, who resigned around this time after the decision by the United States not to use military force, was very discouraged and felt, the message he was getting from the Syrian opposition, the moderate opposition, was that they felt betrayed. And, you know, going forward, they continue to dwindle in number and size. Many of them quit.
And Martin Smith, again, his new Frontline PBS documentary, Obama at War, premieres tonight on PBS stations and online at pbs.org/frontline. Do you think that we're at a similar point now in terms of a game changer, given the red line was crossed and then the consequences weren't met? Now that it appears that Palmyra, this ancient Roman ruin, may be blown up by ISIS. The secular regime of Assad promotes it tremendously. It's even on their currency. So it's hard not to think that given the track record of the self-declared Islamic State in Iraq blowing up antiquities, that this would be a rich target for them. And in a curious way, it seems to me that in many ways the death of over 200,000 people isn't resonating, but the destruction of human history does seem to resonate.
It does. I hate to say this, but we've grown accustomed to these kinds of horrific wars, civil wars, genocides. It seems as if every president recently has one on their watch, whether it's in Bosnia or Rwanda, in the Central African Republic. We're seeing horrific things unfold. We saw problems in the Sudan. On the other hand, seeing history destroyed seems to, like you say, touch a nerve. It's hard to explain, but it's easy to feel it when you see it. So, in some ways, I guess I don't think anybody delights or is passive about what they see happening in terms of the number of men, women, and children being slaughtered. But the antiquities is something that we haven't seen. Well, we saw it with the Taliban and the Bamiyan Buddhas, but by and large, we haven't seen that kind of destruction of antiquities.
But it does seem, though, that the Islamic State are they try to be provocative by executing, beheading journalists on camera. They certainly elicited a response, and I'm wondering whether, if indeed the worst happens with the destruction of Palmyra, whether there'll be a kind of clamor to do something, because after all, the clamor to do something after the public executions of journalists did at least get the Obama administration to make some commitment of special forces into Iraq. And I'm wondering
I think it's going to put pressure on the president to do something, like you say, and I certainly think that ISIS is likely to, in the most provocative way that it can, push those buttons. But I think that President Obama is determined to keep American soldiers out of this war. He sees Syria he sees this situation as one that has to be solved by the region's armies. And I think a lot of the legwork right now is Secretary Kerry's to try to get the nations in the region to take responsibility for what's unfolding in their neighborhood. I don't know what the president could do if there are, you know, if ISIS begins to blow up those columns at Palmyra, those ancient ruins. I'm just not sure what he could think of doing.
But meanwhile, it does seem that the Assads are on their back foot, that the military gains by al-Nusra and the Islamic State are pretty palpable, and they're right in close in now in Damascus, and they're quite near the Alawite heartland. And, of course, as they suffer military reverses, apparently the more and more Iranian micromanagement of the war itself, with the role of Hezbollah increasing. So you'd think that that may even concern the Israelis, who probably at this point are sitting back watching their enemies slaughter each other.
Well, I think there's a real worry that Assad is running out of soldiers. He's depending increasingly on militias from Lebanon and the Hezbollah to come in and fight the war. If Assad falls, the only real forces that can march into Damascus are extremists, and there's three large ones. You name two of them. In addition to the Nusra Front and ISIS, there's Al-Raw al-Sham, and then there's a whole smattering of smaller groups. But there isn't an army of moderates that's going to be up and ready and trained and ready to vie for power in Damascus. So you're looking at an expansion of power in the hands of jihadis. Iran's not going to stand by and let that, you know, doesn't want to let that happen. So it doesn't look very pretty.
Well, it sort of looks like there's going to be a second Syrian war, doesn't it? Well,
that's what does happen in most of these places. The old order falls, but then you have a whole slew of, well, just like when Saddam Hussein fell, and then there were Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and there were the Shia militia, and then, you know, that battle is essentially still going on. So you're going to have a scramble for power after Assad falls.
So having spoken to all of the top administration people in this PBS Frontline documentary, Obama at War, that premieres tonight on PBS stations and online at pbs.org/frontline, Martin Smith, your sense is that the president is actually somebody that's been pushed between those on his side, like inside his administration, like Hillary Clinton and Samantha Power, who wanted him to do something, and then the military people, like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and others, and General Petraeus at the CIA, who didn't want him to get involved. He himself doesn't want to get involved. It sounds to me like that in many ways this is the opposite in terms of temperament to Obama's predecessor, George W. Bush, who often said himself he had a gut feeling and reacted on it.
He was the decider, as he put
yes.
it. Well, Obama is also faced with decisions but has been tortured by them because, I think he's much more reflective by nature than the previous president, and he weighs these things very carefully. He's obviously very smart, and he sees, if he can't see the consequences of step one, he's reluctant to take it. Unfortunately, neither man has had a lot of success in this region. Either George Bush, really the original sin here is the 2003 invasion of Iraq, which really tipped the apple cart and got all this rolling. Now Obama comes into office and is trying to quell what was unleashed. And, you know, it takes a long time to come to decisions, and that hasn't served him very well either.
And, of course, as we enter the political season with the presidential primaries, with so many Republicans hammering at him already, you got Lindsey Graham talking about needing to send an extra 10,000 troops into Iraq. It's going to be tough for Obama to stay out, isn't it?
Oh, I don't think Obama's going to listen to what Lindsey Graham has to say, or even John McCain. I think that what he wants to do is contain ISIS. Now, he says that he wants to degrade and destroy them, but I really think his is a policy of containment. He wants to attack them in Iraq, push them out of Iraq, back into Syria, and reduce them to something like a terrorist group rather than an actual army holding on to real territory. And you know, I don't know that he has any real viable plan for defeating them inside Syria. In fact, to defeat ISIS in Syria, I think you've got to take down Assad. And he does not want to take on that task. It's fraught with too many risks. So at this point, I think his policy is one of push them out of Iraq, contain them inside Syria.
Well, Martin Smith, I thank you very much for joining us, and I look forward to your documentary tonight on PBS stations and online at pbs.org/frontline, Obama at War.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Martin Smith, who's a veteran documentary producer and correspondent, whose most recent PBS Frontline documentary was The Rise of ISIS. He is the writer, producer, and correspondent of Frontline's Obama at War, which premieres tonight on PBS stations and online at pbs.org/frontline. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the competition to build civilian nuclear reactors in the most dangerous parts of the Middle East.
But the atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole list truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bennett Ramberg, who was a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs at the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy, an Unrecognized Military Peril, and has an article at Foreign Affairs, Nuclear Power to the People, the Middle East's New Gold Rush. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bennett Ramberg.
Thank you, Ian. I'm delighted to be here.
And there have been, just before we get into the details of all of these countries clamoring to sell nuclear power plants to countries in the Middle East who are right in the middle of much of the conflagrations that we've been talking about in our earlier segment here, just to get an idea, as your article points out, of how there has already been a record of nuclear power plants as targets during the Yugoslav Civil War. The Serbian military aircraft buzzed Slovenia's Krsko nuclear power reactor. Serbian nationalists had threatened to sabotage the plant. And then, of course, during the Iran-Iraq War, Iran's Bushehr reactor was bombed repeatedly by the Iraqis. Israel's destroyed Iraq's Osirik reactor, and that was in 1981. And 2007, Syria's Al-Kabar reactor, which was under construction. And meanwhile, Israel's reactor at Dimona, which is not a power reactor, produces nuclear weapons. In 1991, Saddam Hussein attacked it with Scud missiles. And in 2014, Hamas attempted to bombard it with missiles as well. And Hezbollah has threatened to strike Dimona with its missiles. And Iran has also announced that the plant is on its hit list as well. So let's not kid ourselves. We know that nuclear power plants, particularly in the Middle East, are targets.
Yes, what a place to put new nuclear reactors. These are power reactors we're talking about. And just to reiterate some of the points that you made, just to step back a moment there, it's been some contemplation or speculation for many years whether nuclear reactors of whatever sort might be attractive terrorist targets or military targets. And the Middle East has been the center point of attacks on reactors. Fortunately, we've not seen reactors which were operating, which were attacked as a consequence. There was no radiological release from the attack on the Osirik reactor or the Al-Kabir reactor. However, in the Slovenian case, it's an interesting case because you had an operating reactor, and this was a power reactor in Slovenia. This was in the midst of the Yugoslav Civil War, and the Serbian government buzzed the plant. And indeed, I was consulted by an Austrian group at the time to find out what they should do, and the plant was actually shut down. That doesn't mean that the plant was invulnerable to release radioactive elements because they shut down operations, but the reactor core remained in the plant. And had the Serbian government or Air Force bombed the plant, nuclear elements would have been released, but they did not. And Serbian nationalists threatened to attack the plant, but they didn't do it. And interestingly enough, when the Kosovo War began, the Serbian government itself was concerned about the possibility that the United States might attack a large research reactor in Belgrade. And they approached the International Atomic Energy Agency, and they asked the agency to intervene with NATO and asked NATO not to attack this larger research reactor, which was in the heart of Belgrade, and the United States never did. And nonetheless, it demonstrated the vulnerability of these type of facilities in the midst of war. And just to go to the Israeli cases, Israel attacked the Osirik reactor in 1981. The concern there was the Iraqis might use that facility as a guise to develop a plutonium weapons program. That was unlikely, but nonetheless, that was the fear of the Israelis. Unfortunately, the Israelis timed the attack intentionally, not to bomb it once the reactor was fueled. And that was the likewise the case in the in Syria. 2007, Syria had imported a nuclear reactor from North Korea secretly, and the Israelis were able to define where the reactor was situated. It appears to have been a plutonium reactor modeled after Korea's nuclear reactor utilized for the production of materials for a weapons program. The story about the bombing of the reactor is kind of interesting in this sense. The Israeli government, Olmert, the prime minister at the time, approached President Bush, and he asked, he brought to Bush's attention the fact that this reactor was under construction. And Bush told Olmert that he would consult his advisors. Olmert asked Bush to bomb the reactor, and Bush consulted his advisors, and the advisors suggested that the matter be taken to the Security Council. And Bush told Olmert in the telephone conversation, this is a reference in Bush's memoirs, Olmert told Bush that he was sorry that Bush had declined to bomb the plant, and then a couple months later, the Israeli Air Force bombed the plant in the midnight attack, and the Syrians denied they ever had a reactor there, but clearly it was a reactor. But again, unfueled, still under construction. So we didn't have the radiological release of any nuclear material.
And again, I'm speaking with Bennett Ramberg, who was a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs at the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy, an Unrecognized Military Peril, and has an article at Foreign Affairs, Nuclear Power to the People, the Middle East's New Gold Rush. So let's talk about the new gold rush to for Western countries, along with China and Russia, to sell nuclear power plants to these countries in the Middle East that are in a very dangerous neighborhood. Russia's set to build 4 reactors in Turkey this year. They've secured agreements to build more in Algeria, Egypt, Iran, and Jordan. South Korea has contracts to build 4 plants in the United Arab Emirates. And then in terms of the real gold rush, which is to sell reactors to the Saudis, who want to build 18 nuclear power reactors. You've got clamoring for that. You've got Argentina, Canada, China, the Czech Republic, Finland, France, Japan, the UK, Russia, and the US. And it seems that the US is the only one of those countries that's in any way restrained, right?
That's right. These various countries are galloping in. The Russians seem to have taken the lead. They have negotiated a number of deals. They are starting to build, or by the end of this year, they will start to build the first of 4 nuclear power plants in Turkey. They were the ones who built the only nuclear power plant that's in operation in the region. That's in Bushehr. That's a very large reactor. That's a power reactor that's in Iran. And just with regard to Iran, the Iranians would like to build, they've given various estimates, but up to a dozen reactors in the years to come. That's how they rationalize the need for an enrichment program, for example. And there's other countries that you've indicated that are interested in nuclear energy. For example, Russia's Vladimir Putin visited Egypt recently and negotiated a deal to provide Egypt with a nuclear reactor. There's been Russian talks in Jordan about building a nuclear reactor. South Korea is already building a reactor in the United Arab Emirates. And other countries are clamoring to provide either energy services, instrumentation, or galloping in with regard to perhaps assisting in the development of nuclear energy as well. The United States, however, is more restrained because of laws that prescribe that these countries adhere to certain nonproliferation criteria, and unless they sign a particular agreement under the Atomic Energy Act, the United States vendors can't easily go forward, although they're discussing this. That is, companies such as General Electric and Toshiba Westinghouse, for example. So it's amazing the number of countries that are trying to explore markets in the region. Mind you, if I could just put this in some historic perspective, there were other periods in time when there were discussions about building reactors in Egypt and Libya and even Syria. One can only imagine, frankly, had there been a reactor in the operating in Syria at the height of the Civil War, what would have happened had the bad guys, so to speak, either targeted the reactor or taken it hostage.
Well, in our earlier interview just preceding you, Bennett Ramberg, we were discussing the real possibility that the ancient Roman ruins of Palmyra will be destroyed by the bad guys, by the self-declared Islamic State. A rich target like a nuclear power plant that could decimate all the neighborhood, particularly if Damascus or wherever Assad's people were downwind. I mean, the point you have to make, I think, surely, when you make the comparison between blowing up one of these nuclear reactors that everybody in the world seems to be clamoring to sell to Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, if Dimona was struck by one of these Scuds or whatever that was aimed at it, or the upgraded missiles that Hezbollah have, assuming that there's another bout of a war between Hezbollah and Israel, even if you were able to blow up, and apparently the facilities are pretty deep underground, the amount of radiation that is released from weapons making is about a thousandth or a ten thousandth of the amount of radiologic material that's in nuclear power plants. The comparisons are huge.
Yeah, the comparisons are huge, and I've actually done a study about the Dimona reactor, its vulnerability. That reactor was targeted by Hamas. At least some of the rockets were thrown in that direction. But during the 1991 Persian Gulf War, the Iraqis tried to launch missiles against the Dimona plant, which begs the question, what would have happened had that plant been destroyed? And as you properly point out, the Dimona reactor is a fraction of what a nuclear power plant would be. But in the study and simulations I did with a colleague, we determined based on weather conditions, and this would be variable depending on the time of year and weather conditions on a particular day, you could have light amounts of radiation flowing over Israel or Jordan or the West Bank, frankly. This may not kill numbers of people. However, it could contaminate lightly large areas of Israel, the West Bank, and even parts of Jordan, and people would, I would say, literally be frightened to death about the consequence. And so this would be, even with a small reactor, very, very concerning to the populations in these regions. So the Dimona reactor nonetheless remains a target, as you indicated in your introduction. The Iranians have threatened to strike the plant. Hezbollah said we will launch many rockets against the plant. So it still remains an attractive target. And one can only imagine that if these reactors were spread about the Middle East, they would become kind of nuclear piñatas for terrorist groups or countries or whatever to strike. And as a consequence, I think it's prudent to start thinking about alternatives. Does this make sense? Is it time to really think again about this particular matter? And I think it does. And one of the things my article attempts to do is to look at some of the options, focusing on solar energy.
Well, before we get to that, because I think, we all know there's plenty of sun in Saudi Arabia. But the Saudis, for example, who want to build 18 nuclear reactors and everybody's beating a path to their doorstep to try and sell them these nuclear reactors, they just had a situation in the Shiite part of Saudi Arabia where the oil fields are. The self-declared Islamic State claimed the credit for blowing up a Shia mosque and killing a bunch of people, which is inciting an attempt to incite secular warfare akin to what's been going on in Iraq. This is not the sign of a country that's particularly stable. I'm just astounded. I guess the people who build nuclear power plants, there's so much money involved, they don't really think the consequences through. They're not in the business of the moral consequences so much as the cash on the barrel.
Well, the vendors are thinking about the businesses they're in and marketing as many reactors as they possibly can. I mean, there's other areas of the world where vendors are trying to sell reactors, including Pakistan and India. China's self-building a number of reactors, for example. The United States is not. It's backing away from nuclear energy, and Europe likewise. But the Middle East is really a market that remained untapped. Many of the leaders of these countries evidently believe that nuclear energy is associated with modernization, and they want the atom. They have the vendors who are out there who are clamoring to sell them the reactors. And remarkably, the issue that I've raised has been, at least in the literature that I see, almost entirely ignored. What has been focused on, however, is the presumption that, well, if you get a number of reactors, this could rationalize the development of a fuel cycle program. By this, I mean the development of enrichment facilities or reprocessing facilities, and this would open the door to nuclear weapons. So there has been some focus on that, but not on the vulnerability of these plants to terrorist attack or the regional conflicts, regional war.
in spite of the evidence which we outlined in the beginning. That's
correct. It's the only region in the world where we've actually had attacks, mind you, on facilities that were not operating. The Israelis were very careful to strike plants that did not have any nuclear materials in them. But mind you, the Iranians Hamas did attempt to strike the Dimona reactor, which is an operating facility.
So in terms of the solution, which is glaring, you know, like the sun blasting through your windshield, the solar energy, there are some indications that Qatar or one of the Gulf Emirates is working, the United Arab Emirates are working on solar power. So where does that stand in terms of the race? You got all these vendors clamoring to sell nuclear power reactors to these countries in the Middle East. What about solar? Anybody, their salesmen out there too?
Yes, there are salesmen and there is interest. If I may step back, one of the things that stimulated the article was an announcement, frankly, here in Los Angeles by Elon Musk or in the LA area that he was going to develop industrial-sized batteries for solar power plants. And here in California, we actually generate more solar energy than we consume. But one of the problems is it's a dissipating type of energy because there's no batteries to store it. But we're on the cusp of developing industrial-sized batteries. And that's been a problem for solar energy around the world. So if you take a country like Saudi Arabia, it plans by 2040 to generate about one-third of their energy with solar. And this is on the presumption that it won't have any battery technology, I believe. With the battery technology, it could generate all of its energy, that is electricity, with solar energy. It wouldn't have to rely on the proposed 18 nuclear power plants. In the case of the UAE, the Emirates, there is, until I think it was 2013, they have the largest operating solar plant in the world. Now I believe it's California that has the largest solar plant in the world. But that country, likewise, wants to go nuclear because they want to have a mix. And they believe that nuclear energy is part of modernization. Yet, what's part of modernization in the 21st century is really not nuclear. For a solar-rich area such as the Middle East, it is solar power.
Well, you know, I'm always, I keep repeating this, that Germany, which doesn't exactly have a lot of sunlight, is leading the world in solar power. And there was a weekend of a year or so ago, I think it was, where half of the grid was supplied by solar and wind. So it's always struck me as an extraordinary irony that countries and states like California haven't been able to seize what they take for granted with the sun shining every day, and really make this make an example of solar power.
Well, as you know, California is becoming a model, I think, for the United States with regard to alternative energy sources, solar as well as wind power, and we have a mandate from the state government to extract much of our energy from alternative sources. So we've become a national leader in that regard. But the region we're talking about is so rich in solar energy, it's actually occurring. I mean, we have countries, for example, such as Algeria, that is already generating about 250 megawatts of solar energy. Jordan plans to generate about 200 megawatts of solar energy. A typical nuclear power plant is about 1,000 megawatts, so these plants have to be a lot larger than are being planned. But nonetheless, the possibilities are there. They're real, and solar energy is becoming, it's already arguably more competitive than nuclear power plants at this time, both in the construction, which can take just a few years rather than a decade in the case of a nuclear power plant. So we are there, we're on the cusp of being there with regard to the region. And these countries should think again, particularly when you consider not only the economics, but the security issue.
Well, but that means that security officials, if indeed they exist, that have a lot of credibility, got to step up and speak out, don't they?
They have to step up. But curiously, the issue that I've raised has been ignored. I'm just amazed. It's been ignored. Now, mind you, prior to the development of the Syrian civil war, the Arab Spring, and so on, you know, the violence that had been precipitating around the Middle East was not as extreme as we see today. Now, we don't know what the future of the region is going to be yet. Countries around the region are planning these facilities. Not only planning, but in the case of Turkey, the UAE are actually building these facilities, and Iran has plans to start construction in the next few years. And Saudi Arabia is looming, as well as other countries, Egypt and so on.
Well, Bennett Ramberg, I thank you for joining us. I think this is a very important story, and I hope people pay attention.
I appreciate it, Ian. Have a nice day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Bennett Ramberg, who was a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs at the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy, an Unrecognized Military Peril. And he has an article at Foreign Affairs, Nuclear Power to the People, the Middle East's New Gold Rush. We're going to take a brief station break and be back speaking with a marine ecologist on the lasting effects on marine life, birds, and mammals of the Santa Barbara oil spill. I wanted to walk through the empty streets and feel something constant under my feet, but all the news reports recommended that I stay indoors because the air outside will make ourselves divide. Now the deep water horizon descends down to the death's door, and at the bird's foot they've lost all hope. 'Cause all the leaves are drifting for miles and miles, poisoning the Gulf of Mexico. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Miller, a research biologist in the Marine Science Institute at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and with the Santa Barbara Coastal Long-Term Ecological Research Program, where he researches emerging contaminants to marine ecosystems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Miller.
Thank you, Ian.
And the cleanup is underway from this burst oil pipeline that has contaminated beaches just to the slightly very close to the UCSB campus, my understanding is that there's some concern that these chemical dispersants are being used. The Coast Guard said they're not being used. Let's start with that. Are chemical dispersants being used, just to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge. I hope not. I certainly hope not. There's been a lot of work on the toxicity of dispersants, and they've been shown to be very toxic to a variety of marine organisms. So we hope they're not being used, and I haven't seen any evidence that they are.
But they were used extensively in the Gulf oil spill.
That's right. They were pumped directly down to the seafloor to break up the oil as it was coming out of the well. And they've been used in a lot of oil spills in the past. And because of that, for example, the big spill in Prince William Sound. And so because of that legacy, we know the devastating effects that those dispersants can have on marine life, even more so in some cases than the oil itself.
So what do we make of the conflicting stories about protesters being turned away, volunteering to do cleanup on these beaches, and now there are reports that there's been an open call now to have volunteers come and clean up on Tuesday at Refugio State Beach, so, and at El Capitan State Beach as well. So what's your understanding? Plains All American Pipeline Company, they've been turning people away, but at this point, are volunteers being allowed to go in and help?
Apparently, that's true. They are. They have to take a 4-hour hazmat training course, apparently because of safety concerns that the oil, exposure to oil is not good. I mean, in reality, you know, a good pair of gloves and some protective gear will protect you pretty well from the amount of oil that we're seeing on the beach, which is not, it's not feet thick oil like there was in the Gulf. But still, it's important to be safe, and they're training people to make sure that everybody is knows what they're doing out there, rather than just letting people out on the beach with their dogs and stuff and getting oil everywhere.
But I understand that you have been trying to get permission to dive off the coast there, where the oil slick is in the ocean, right?
That's right. Yeah, we did go diving actually on Friday, but since then they've sort of become more organized, and we just got some verbal permission to do that. Since then, now they've gotten more organized, and they want us to get formal permission. So we put the request in for that this morning, and we're waiting to hear back. Some other researchers from UCSB have gotten permission to dive, so we hope that they'll do that quickly before it becomes impossible to see where the oil is on the bottom. On Friday, we did see some oil on the seafloor off the site, so we're hoping to figure out what its distribution is with depth and what effects it might be having on seafloor life.
So who makes the decision of whether or not you can inspect the ocean floor for oil?
Well, that's a good question. The other researcher gave me their permission slip, and it's signed by several different people from I have it right here. It's signed by five different people that are in the response team, is my understanding. A EPA representative, Coast Guard, and some other people, and one person from the oil company.
Well, apparently the Plains All American Oil Company are taking the pipe out, aren't they?
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Right. Well, again, I'm speaking with Robert Miller, who's a research biologist in the Marine Science Institute at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's also with the Santa Barbara Coastal Long-Term Ecological Research Program, where he researches emerging contaminants to marine ecosystems. The coverage on that I've seen on network news, particularly on NBC, was just appalling, where they had the CEO of Plains All American strolling down the beach with this NBC reporter, Holly somebody or other, as though they were a couple of honeymooners on a stroll, and real softball friendly, no mention of the incredible numbers of citations and that this company, Plains All American, had for endangering the environment, and the fact that this particular oil pipeline that ruptured didn't have an automatic shutoff valve. And apparently people were aware of it, and they sued Plains All American to put in this safety device. And Plains All American went to court and got a judge to give them relief to keep this pipeline operating. And look what it led to. I mean, do you know anything about the history of these lawsuits and who this judge is and who's responsible for obviously now they're in full PR mode, and they're trying to tell us. I mean, the CEO of Plains All American said on NBC, you know, bad things happen to good people. I mean, it was the most unbelievable softball pseudo piece of journalism I've ever seen.
Yeah, well, I'm sure I'm just hearing about all this stuff as well. I didn't know about these lawsuits in the past. Most of our research is not on oil, but on marine ecology. But I'm sure that decision is going to, I'm sure they're regretting that decision now. You know, oil development off the coast is an inherently risky activity for the marine ecosystem, and any and all precautions should be taken to avoid this kind of thing. And if they're not, you know, obviously there should be penalties.
So from the point of view, though, of a marine ecologist, what does oil do? We know you mentioned, we talked about how bad the contaminants are that are used to clean it up. But the oil itself, my understanding is, for example, in the Gulf, there's a huge dead zone around where the BP blowout happened in the Gulf to this day, and there's still oil contaminating the bottom of the ocean. But in terms of what you've seen in Santa Barbara and what you're trying to, you obviously want to see more of it, what does it do?
Well, it's a little early to say what the full impacts will be, but clearly, you know, oil has a big impact on organisms that at first oil floats, and so we expect the biggest impacts to be on animals that are at the surface, things like birds and marine mammals that have to come to the surface to breathe and use the surface as a feeding area. And then the oil blows into shore or is carried by waves ashore where it impacts things that live on the shore, smothers them directly, or and it's also just toxic, you know, especially at first, a lot of the lighter oil compounds are volatilizing. PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, are coming off that oil, and they're very toxic to everything, and that's why they have the volunteers wearing these hazmat suits and masks, because that stuff is toxic to humans as well. So, and then, you know, we're also seeing, even beyond that floating oil, we're also seeing some oil on the bottom of the ocean, and whether we're not sure if it's sinking there now because the oil's degrading, that's probably the case, but it's also being churned under with the waves. And so now it's floating around on the seafloor, releasing these toxic substances and potentially killing marine life down there.
So is there a way to get clean it up? Because as far as I can tell, they skim it and they scoop the sand up, but do they really get rid of it?
Well, they can't clean all of it up. No, I think that's impossible. They can, and all the cleanup methods are basically brute force type methods where they're going out and cleaning off, sponging off rocks, you know, like you said, scooping up sand and disposing of it as hazardous waste, trying to skim it off the water, and that works, especially in the beginning part. You know, you can get a lot of it up that way, but much of it disperses really rapidly, and so to some extent that lessens the impact of it because it dilutes the toxins, but it also makes it just hard to figure out what the impact is because the impact is spread over such a large area.
So at this point, since you have been able to dive, although some of your colleagues did on Friday, you don't know what's really going on, but in terms of being able to fly over and look at it, what's the latest report on how much of the beaches have been contaminated? And they're saying that they're going to open these beaches by, I think, June the 5th.
Right. I'm not sure what the latest report is. I've been occupied all day with trying to get this permission and other things, and from what we've seen, most of the affected beaches are north and west of where the spill occurred, because that's the way the currents were moving and carried the oil. And they have been working to clean up the oil on those beaches. A lot of the coast, though, along this area is backed by bluffs, you know, big cliffs. And so there really is no beach. So a lot of the oil up against the cliffs and maybe sinking on the seafloor, and that's what we're interested in. Our divers did see some evidence, some dead crabs and sea urchins and other things on the bottom when they dove on Friday. And so we'd like to get out there to explore that further, and we're hoping that it's not too serious.
Well, it's kind of an irony, isn't it, that this oil spill happened on the same stretch of beaches that happened with the famous disastrous Santa Barbara oil spill back in the late 60s.
That's right. It is a wake-up call. You know, the 69 oil spill was much larger than this, obviously, millions of barrels or millions of gallons. I think it was 9 million gallons or something like that. And the Santa Barbara Harbor was completely covered with oil. It was really devastating spill and really really mobilized people. But you can see with the Gulf spill and subsequent spills that these things keep happening, and they will keep happening as long as we're developing oil off the coast and transporting it like this. It's just an inherently risky activity. But like I said, there are some precautions that these companies can take. One of them is the safety shutoff of these pipes that wasn't taken in this case, and that needs to be enforced rigorously.
So tell us about the nanomaterials that you research in the marine ecosystem. My understanding is that these tiny sort of plastic beads that they put in toothpaste and other consumer items, for reasons I'm not entirely sure, have made their way into the marine ecosystem, into fish, and people actually end up ingesting this stuff. And it, most of all, marine life ingests it, and it's obviously toxic to them.
Yeah, I was. That's been in the news a lot lately. Those are plastic microbeads. They're actually a lot larger than nanoparticles, and they're very common in things like facial scrubs and body washes and things like that as exfoliating agents. And apparently there are tons of these things moving through the sewage treatment plants and accumulating in the marine environment. And we really have no idea what effect those kinds of things are having that we're putting in the marine environment. So all these things are happening at a pace that's too fast for any individual researcher to keep up with. It's insane, actually. I'm involved with a new project we have here at UCSB called the Biodiversity Observation Network, where we're trying to create a prototype system to get a better idea of the state of marine biodiversity off the coasts of our country. You know, at present, there's a lot of different little studies that happen, but we really have very little idea of what is happening with the total community of animals and plants that are out there at any given time. And therefore, when a disaster like this happens, or when you have impacts like the microbeads, it's really hard to say what their impacts are in a lot of cases, because we don't know what's out there to begin with.
So what are the nanoparticles you're looking into?
We mostly look at metal oxide nanoparticles, including things like zinc oxide and titanium dioxide that are common ingredients in cosmetics like sunscreens, as well as titanium dioxide is even used in food like skim milk to make it whiter.
Mm. Remind me not to drink any skim milk. Well,
these particles, you know, they dissolve and release toxic metals into the water that can kill things like plankton. And they also create reactive oxygen species like hydrogen peroxide that can stress organisms out that are already exposed to lots of other stresses in the environment.
Well, the fact that this stuff is used in, or is an ingredient in sunscreen, and people go into the ocean covered in sunscreen, so you know it's getting into the ocean, right?
That's right. And in some case, and experiments have shown that sunscreen, that these particles found in sunscreen can be toxic to things like corals, for example. And so you've got to wonder in places where there's a lot of swimmers going into the water, what effect that's having on the reefs in the tropics, and here on the plankton along the shore.
Well, Robert Miller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Miller, who's a research biologist in the Marine Science Institute at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's also with the Santa Barbara Coastal Long-Term Ecological Research Program, where he researches emerging contaminants to marine ecosystems. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.